9.
This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Welcome to Keeping the Faith. I'm Don Nolan. I'm filling in for Steve this afternoon, Steve Shoemaker, who is the usual guest host of this program. Our topic this afternoon can hardly be more topical. If you've been keeping up with the national news, the U.S. Senate is debating an immigration reform bill. Many observers say something labeled an immigration reform bill will pass the Senate and even the Republican-controlled House of Representatives, if only because of demographics. Voters of Spanish-speaking heritage in this country are the fastest-growing political constituency in the country, according to many accounts. In order to accomplish something like immigration reform, Democrats, even progressives, have accepted beefed-up border security as a political trade-off. However, the human impact of border militarization on the lives of immigrants and their families often goes unrecognized or is ignored. And our guests this afternoon know firsthand what that human toll is. Indeed, they have written about it most recently as nationally published co-authors in The Nation and Tycoon magazine. In their day jobs, they're active workers with an organization called No More Deaths. No More Deaths was founded in 2004 as a coalition of faith-based communities in Arizona, mostly, I think. Its mission is to address death and suffering on the U.S.-Mexico border. And both of our guests are active Desert Aid volunteers associated with the program called No More Deaths. They are Kate Morgan Olson, a human rights activist who has worked on the border since 2010, and she's here with us in the studio. Welcome to the program, Kate.
Thanks so much.
We're hoping to get online, if possible. We're having a little technical difficulty doing so. A co-author that she's worked with over the years, Catherine Gaffney. Catherine is a writer and activist living in Tucson, Arizona right now. Is that right?
That's correct.
And I don't think Catherine is with us yet, but we'll hear from her hopefully a little later on the program once we establish contact. Let me remind our listeners, this is a call-in program, and if you have a question or comment to make, please call in at 333-9455. If you are not in the 217 area code, you can call our 800 number, 1-800-222-9455. So before we talk about your Desert Aid work, Kate, tell us a little bit about yourself. I happen to know that you are a townie. You grew up right here in Champaign-Urbana. So tell us a little bit about your journey from Champaign to where you are today.
Yeah, I am from Champaign, and it's really nice to be home. I haven't been home in a long time.
It is Father's Day.
It is Father's Day. Happy Father's Day to my dad. I grew up here. I graduated from Central High School in 1998. I went to Beloit College and studied anthropology and Latin American studies there, and then moved to Chicago and spent a good amount of years working within the public health system and was doing more specifically sort of outreach and education with the Latino populations in Cook County. And then moved to Seattle, where I did my graduate studies in social work and also in public administration. While I was there, I was doing some organizing on the University of Washington Seattle campus, working with an anti-racism organizing group, and I met a group of students called the Latino Law Students Association. We were working together pretty closely, and they had planned a trip, actually, to Arizona to work with No More Deaths. And they were like, Kate, this seems right up your alley. Why don't you come down with us? And I spent a week of an alternative spring break program in working with No More Deaths in 2010 and was absolutely hooked. Was like, it resonated with everything I believed in, and the work was meaningful, and then we relocated, my husband and I relocated there in 2011 to start working.
Yep. Quite a journey.
Yeah.
Catherine Gaffney is your co-author. What was the name of the op-ed piece that you did for Nation magazine? Just published, I believe.
Uh, I actually didn't come up with the title. The editor did, but I believe it was something like How Immigration Reform Puts Migrants' Lives at Risk.
Right.
Yeah.
Very well written. Tell us a little bit about Catherine. She perhaps will get on and fill us in, but she went to college in Swarthmore, I understand, and is from Brooklyn and moved from Brooklyn to Arizona. Is that right?
Yeah. Catherine graduated from Swarthmore and has been working as a grant writer for a number of years. She's sort of a contract grant writer, and that enables her to move around and be a part of a lot of different projects. And very similar, I think, to my journey, she came down to volunteer with No More Deaths. I don't remember how she found out about it. She came down to volunteer and was just like, this is what I want to be doing. I feel so compelled to be here, and relocated as well, started working full-time with No More Deaths the same year I did, which was 2011.
Mm-hmm. And you've both been doing this since 2011 or 2010? I thought it was longer than that.
Yeah, so both of us have been volunteering with No More Deaths sort of on a temporary basis since 2010. I think actually she might have started in 2009, but both of us then relocated to work full-time on the border in 2011.
Now, she's year-round designated worker.
Yeah, she is year-round. And I was too up until we recently relocated to Chicago, but we were both working there full-time on the border for a long time.
Well, tell us a little bit about how No More Deaths as an organization came into being.
In 2004, people in Tucson really started to see the impacts of border militarization and also some of the driving factors of immigration. So, you know, a lot of people were leaving Mexico specifically because there wasn't work. And they were coming up through this militarized zone of the border, and people were literally finding bodies of people who had perished in their yards, like right around Green Valley. People were finding people's bodies, and a group of pastors came together, and religious leaders came together and said, this is ridiculous. You know, no matter where your politics are, people should not have to die coming here. And they co-founded a group called Samaritans First and then No More Deaths later.
Right.
And so since then, the first project that sort of came to being was the Desert Aid Work, which is the piece that Catherine and I have been most involved with, and is we maintain a presence in the desert, the portion of the desert where the most deaths occur. We're there to provide food, water, and medical assistance to people crossing through that area. So we have a camp where sometimes people walk in and they need medical assistance. But we also have a pretty good idea of what the trail system in that area looks like, and we go out to the trails to put food and water out on those trails so that people have access to them as they're walking as well.
And you regularly hike those trails, as I understand it, to look for people who might need aid?
That's correct. We are out on those trails every day. First, to make sure that we are keeping the water and food stashed, but also just to have a presence. A lot of times when people are injured or left behind, they don't want to make themselves known because they don't know if you're Border Patrol, if you're somebody who wants to hurt them or not. And so just being on the trails allows people to kind of see a visual on you and see who you are. And we've had people approach us on the trails who need who are in desperate need of help as well.
Now, you mentioned the area where most people come. I think a lot of people think perhaps incorrectly, I don't know what the what the general impression is, that it's the big cities, but it's no longer the big cities anymore. That's been pretty well shut down. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. So it used to be the big cities. You're right. And that's what people think about. In the mid-90s, that's when we started to seeing Operation Gatekeeper, Operation Hold the Line. And that was an attempt to seal off any points of crossing through those urban centers. So the way that another thing that I don't think people really fully appreciate is the way that the wall has been used is not necessarily to seal the border. It's to funnel traffic into deadly places where people will walk and they will become lost and hurt and die. And through a formalized policy called prevention through deterrence, then, the idea is that the journey will be made so difficult from being forced to cross through these mountainous areas in this desert area that it will prevent people from wanting to cross at all.
So it's a deliberate attempt to funnel people where the most dangerous place to cross is.
Right.
And so the dangerousness is part of the deterrence.
Right.
I see.
Yeah. It's not the wall itself. It's what the wall does.
And what's dangerous about this is the heat and the distance and the guides who they pay. Would you say, I think someone said somewhere around 5,000, 6,000 and up per person or per family. And they're abused because they can't be. It's got to be a terrifying experience.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the zone where people are walking is very desolate. There are private ranches in the area, but not many. Mm-hmm. So by the time that people make it into sort of where we have a presence, they haven't seen people, like other people other than their groups, in days sometimes. Mm-hmm. And during that journey, anything can happen. For women, the journey is especially horrific. And, you know, we know assault to be endemic to that. Mm-hmm. Women know that too. And they come prepared. We've heard of people saying that they've started taking birth control pills just in order to prevent a pregnancy from what they assume will be an assault that happens on their northward journey.
Mm-hmm. You say there's underreporting of what the reality is on the border. And part of the reason for publishing these two editorials in May in Tacoon magazine and then your op-ed in The Nation magazine, I gather, is to try to bring the reality to bear to public consciousness? Is that your intent behind these?
Yeah, and maybe underreporting is a misrepresentation, but certainly a reporting of our perspective isn't something that happens often. Mm-hmm. Catherine and I actually started talking about wanting to write something about this time last year when there was a article that was published by the Pew Institute for Research and saying that immigration was at a standstill, that it wasn't happening. And we were in the desert just seeing people every day. We were like, how is... Who are they talking to? Because we're not talking to that. We are not seeing this happen.
Right.
And from that, we were like, well, obviously, we need to get our perspective out there because our perspective is very different from what policymakers are seeing or what law enforcement is saying or what even, you know, research institutes are saying. It's important to have that perspective out
there.
In
fact, one of the points you want to make is that current reform language is going to be even more harmful. And we'll talk about that some more. But I understand mm-hmm. that... your co-author and co-worker, Catherine Gaffney, is on the line. Catherine, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hey, you made it.
Yay!
Yes, I made it. Yay.
Sorry for all the trouble. It's not always easy when you're on a cell phone and this far away. So are you in Tucson?
I'm in southern Arizona, actually, about 13 miles north of the border in Aravaca, the town that we based out of.
Doing your work.
Yep, that's right.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us. Have you been able to listen in at all recently? We were talking about underreporting of the reality on the border.
Yes, and thank you, Kate, for filling in on my background as well. But yes, I heard the last few minutes.
Well, why don't you tell us from your perspective, what are some things that are not getting publicized that the public needs to know as they reflect on the current immigration reform bill that is about to pass and apparently increase billions of dollars to further militarize the border and build more fences? Is that right?
Yes, that's right. One thing that, you know, I think is not fully appreciated is that, you know, for the last 20 years, we've had a huge buildup of border security spending and infrastructure. And essentially, the number of people who've been apprehended along the border is the same. So we had spent $187 billion since 1986, which is the last time we had reform measures passed. We had 1 million people apprehended in 2008, and we had 1 million people apprehended in 1993. So, you know, we don't see border security spending as really impacting migration, but what we do see is this modern crisis in death along the border. And so that's what's new, and that's what we mm-hmm. think is the real impact of border security spending.
We are talking to Kate Morgan Olson and Catherine Gaffney, both of whom are desert aid workers who have recently published the reality as they see it from about their work, about the human toll of border militarization, which is a term used in their publications for what's really going on the border and the human impact that this has on immigrants and immigrant families. And This is timely because, as I understand it, in the next week or two, the Senate is going to be voting on an immigration law, a reform law, that will then be sent back to the House. And one of the points made by Catherine and Kate in their very well-written articles is that the increased securitization of the border is going to make things even worse. So if you're interested in talking with our guest about this topic, you can call in locally at 333-9455. If you're outside of the 217 area code, we have an 800 number, 1-800-222-9455. We'd love to hear from you if you'd like to check in. So there is a remarkable passage opening your Nation magazine article. You write, "We built a shrine for him, a wooden cross, desert stone, rosary, a gallon of water mark where his body was found, 13 miles north of the Mexican border in Arizona's Sonoran Desert, the deadliest migration corridor of our southwest border. He may have stopped to rest, weary and sick, from the walk north and never woke up, because only his bones remain. He's unlikely to be identified, and his family will never know what happened to him." Is this something you all personally saw or came on, or are you reporting?
Our friends, neither Catherine nor I were the people who recovered this particular person.
Okay.
Very good friends of ours did. I was there to build the shrine, but I wasn't there for the recovery. I think, though, something that's really powerful about this passage that I want to highlight, at least, is that we don't know how many people die on the border, because what we only know is how many people's bodies are found.
Right.
And there are some organizations that think that the number of people who die crossing are about 10 times as many as the bodies found. So it's when we say, you know, his family will never know, that's a very common occurrence. People right. disappear on our border every day. Their families never have any answers because their bodies are never found. And even if they are recovered, it's just bones. And there's no way then to be able to identify them to get that information back to them. Is there anything else you wanted to add, Catherine?
No, I think that it's just a testament to how vast this area is that people are forced to cross through. I mean, it's days and weeks of walking. And when we do, you know, meet people in need of help, it's just a needle in a haystack. I mean, we literally stumble upon people. The trend is that more and more often the bodies that are being recovered really are just bones. And that's, you know, that speaks to how far out people are being forced to walk and how far out they're dying.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, how long it is before their fates are known, if they are ever known.
Do you have any other stories that you've encountered similar to that? What are the cases that are the most memorable to you that you've dealt with? Have you encountered, I'm sure you've, do you do rescue work at all, or do you encounter people who are still walking and alive? What is the typical encounter that you have?
We do get called in for search and rescue or search and recovery. Those cases are difficult because oftentimes the information that we get for search and rescue or search and recovery is dated.
Mm-hmm.
It means that somebody has made it to safety to be able to get that information back. So it's many weeks later. And oftentimes it's like, we left this person behind. They were sick. They were next to a cactus and a big mountain.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very, very difficult to actually successfully find someone who's alive at that point in time. I haven't had as much experience with SARS as Catherine, though. I don't know if Catherine has more stories about that.
Catherine?
Sure.
Have you been involved in any rescue work?
I have, and honestly, they're almost never successful because of what Kate's saying, that we get this information, and even if initially we think we might recognize the landmarks that, you know, people are describing, once you get out and start walking the trails, I mean, you know, we assume a person can walk 20 to 30 miles a day, and if it takes 3 to 4 days for someone to get to safety and report someone missing, the radius of where that person could potentially be is just enormous. I've worked on different search and rescues, but it's extremely rare, unfortunately, that we're able to actually figure out what happened to somebody.
So in your article, you mentioned, excuse me for interrupting you, in your article, you mentioned, in addition to just bringing aid, food and water, sometimes there are medical assistance as well. Is that right?
Yes. So when we do run into people who are in dire condition, we will evacuate them to medical care. Often that means calling an ambulance and having the ambulance mm-hmm. meet us on a paved road, because we'll be out on the back road so far that, you know, most ambulance crews wouldn't be able to reach us. We've done helicopter evacuations. It depends a bit on exactly where we are. But
that's risky.
And we do provide...
Go ahead.
It can be, yes. I was just going to say that we also have a first aid clinic at our camp, and we do a lot of medical work there for people who sort of stumble into camp and mm-hmm. might have a athletic injury or might need to be rehydrated.
Mm-hmm.
And many of us have some level of medical training.
Well, let's move on and talk a little bit about what is it that you all are hoping to accomplish by raising awareness here. One thing that struck me, we live in a mostly university town where this program is being broadcast, and this question goes to the heart for a lot of folks. You indicate that one of the things you're hoping to do is to take progressives and liberals to task for supporting an immigration reform bill that calls for more militarization without first educating themselves on the human toll. Are you having much luck in that regard?
I'm not sure about that.
What feedback are you getting from progressives and liberal readers of The Nation magazine?
I think that people are surprised. I mean, I think that, again, what the reality of the border is mostly invisible to the vast majority of the United States. What I hope that people do is read that article. It puts a human face to border militarization and the impact of it, and that they're able to more critically think about what immigration reform is going to mean in terms of further militarization of the border. I mean, I don't know that we're going to single-handedly sort of flip the switch and make people oppose border militarization, but I hope to give people a more critical analysis of what's happening on the border.
It is a moving article. It really is, the stories that you tell. Catherine, you say that... when you found out about the work of No More Deaths and becoming a Desert Aid worker, Kate says that this just became clear to you that this is exactly what you wanted to do for the next few years of your life. Tell us a little bit about what grabbed your passion.
Sure. The first time I came out to the desert was in the fall of 2009, and I just came through our open volunteer program, which runs most of the summer and into the fall, and, you know, people from all around the country come and spend time with us working out in the desert. So I just came as a one-week volunteer. I've been working at a youth agency in New York City that served immigrant youth, and, you know, obviously New York, like many cities, is a city of immigrants, and I got to the border and realized I just had no idea what people were going through to get to the place where I was meeting them. And it just completely, you know, struck me, and it sort of got a hold of me. I spent a bunch of time coming back in 2010, and then, like Kate said, I moved here in 2011 to be able to engage with the work all year. But
one of the things that you all wrote about that I did not know was a surprise was this recycling process that you described. So many are deported. And I think you even formulated a rough principle: for everyone deported, you know you're going to get another one coming back. Can you describe that a little bit? Be a little bit more specific. Do you have numbers about that, or how do we understand that, Catherine?
Sure. Well, yeah, we know that under Obama, We're just about to hit the 2 million mark of deportation since he came into office. I can also say that's a trend that we've seen more and more in the desert that is reflected in terms of who we run into. It's incredibly rare to encounter someone trying to cross the desert
for the first time.
For whom this is their first time, exactly. We meet people who don't even speak Spanish because they've lived in the country, you know, since they were kids.
Wow.
And it's just the most, you know, the most common stories are, I was living in Chicago and I got picked up on a traffic violation, got sent to detention and deported to a country away from, you know, my family or my job or, you know, my community.
So is it fair to say that that there really is just sort of a recycle going on? There's not really that many more coming from Honduras, El Salvador, Guatemala, Mexico, who are brand new, that it is, that the incredibly large number of people that are being deported from the United States are trying to find their way back. Is that what's going on?
I mean, I think that is, as Catherine just said, we're meeting a lot of that kind of story in the desert, folks who have experienced a deportation. When we wrote that sort of piece in the first article about how we didn't believe that immigration was truly at a standstill because there were so many deportations,
right,
et cetera, et cetera, that was sort of in context of a study that specifically was looking at immigration or migration from Mexico. And then outside of that, there is, last year especially, we were seeing, I think the majority of people we were seeing in 2012 were from Central America. And people who are coming from Central America, it's interesting because it's a little bit of a different story. From Mexico, it's either people who have lived in the United States and have been deported, or people who, sort of the traditional story is economic refugees, people mm-hmm. whose home communities have been kind of ravaged by free trade laws and there's no work there for them, and
right,
they come north for work. In Central America, there's a very different context. There is still the context of economic insecurity. But on top of that, there's a lot of people who are experiencing violence, tremendous violence associated with cartels, associated with the drug wars, associated with very corrupt regimes. One individual I met in the desert last spring, I met him because he was actually sitting at one of our water drops. And he had been in the desert for 15 days total, 5 days without food and water when I started talking to him and he received aid from us. And he had left Honduras, which has the highest murder rate in the world, because he had been playing soccer. He lived in a poor neighborhood. He had been playing soccer. And the Mareros, a gang there called the Mareros, had showed up on the field. Apparently somebody on his soccer team had wronged them. They opened fire and they shot 14 of his friends. And he managed to escape. But they knew he managed to escape. So they repeatedly came back to his home to harass him and his wife to the point where they couldn't even leave the house. At some point in time, his wife was like, "You have got to leave. This is horrible. You can't leave the house. I can't leave the house. The kids aren't safe." And he set off north. Something to know about Central Americans is that it's not just getting to the border. I mean, getting to the border is like as big as getting across the border, because mm-hmm. they're having to ride on the sides of trains, not a commuter train, but actually holding on to the side of a freight train through most of Mexico just to get up to the U.S.-Mexico border.
For hours, isn't that?
For days. Yes. It takes most people from Central America who I talk to, it takes about a month and a half to get to the U.S.-Mexico border from wherever they are. So there's a lot of violence that's also sort of pushing people out of their communities to try and find safety within the United States.
Mm-hmm. Is this the gang that itself was deported? There was some gang.
The Salvatrucha. I believe they're all. I'm not sure what the exact affiliation is, but that is, you know, one of the consequences of deportation, that we sort of export the gangs back to the you know, original home countries.
This particular gang reformed.
Yeah, this gang did reform.
It was
from Los Angeles into Central America, and now is reformed as MS-13, basically, as far as I know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is absolutely remarkable. Well, that the larger picture here, you discuss in your article as well, or in your two op-ed pieces, and that is that when people say to you, if they ever do, I don't think you run into folks who complain about this. I don't know about you, Catherine, but those who complain that what's going on in Central America and Mexico is their problem, not ours, your article, to a large extent, attempts to refute that, that we're very much, as a country, because of our own policies and economic and other social policies, foreign policy, contribute to the very problem that we're building a wall to prevent. Is that fair, Catherine?
Right, right. It always strikes me in speaking with, you know, the people we run into, how large the U.S. looms over Latin America and how easy it is for us in the U.S. to not feel the mirror of that. And what we were really trying to get at with our article is that immigration reform does not treat the sending conditions for these people. So many aspects of U.S. policy just have a massive effect on Latin America, and that would include free trade policies like NAFTA that have made it extremely difficult for people to sustain agriculture in their home countries, because you're essentially bringing, you know, Mexican farmers into competition with U.S. subsidized agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
And our drug policies have a huge effect on sort of the organizations that now run the border. The drug cartel, the Mexican cartels, have control of everything that moves across the border, at least on their side. And by making it, first of all, by keeping marijuana legal, and second of all, by making it so hard to cross,
mm-hmm.
we've handed them just enormous profits in the last 10 years.
And that also applies to the gun trade as well, I think.
Absolutely, yeah.
Well, you all, I take it, are pretty negative about the language of the reform bill by the so-called Gang of Eight in the Senate. I don't know if you've read it, but apparently you have. The increased amount of money, I think Senator McCain, you said, is asking for another $6.5 billion, or is it $1.5 billion to increase building?
It's 6.5 when you add it all up,
right.
And I think it's $1.5 billion for defense, for increased defense.
And over how many years is it we spent $185 billion? Two decades.
That's since the last reform bill was passed in 1986. We spent $18 billion last year.
20-some odd years.
Yeah, yep.
And
one thing to note there is that part of that $6.5 billion would be to add another 3,500 Border Patrol agents. The force right now is at just over 21,000 agents along both the southern and northern border, and it was only 4,000 agents in 1993. And again, when you look at apprehension numbers, you really don't see that translate. The apprehension numbers seem tied more to the economy than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
So it's more money for strategies that, you know, the one thing Kate and I can really say is that these strategies cause an enormous amount of death and suffering, and there's no metrics that show that they work.
And that's what's remarkable, I think, to so many people who look at this amount of money. Why aren't they working? I mean, if the, what do they call it, full spectrum surveillance that the military has at its disposal with that many miles of walls, with rounding people up and funneling them into these remote areas where they encounter such death and harm, the flow has not stopped. Is that right?
I guess that my answer to that, and then I'll let Catherine throw her two cents in too, is that what border militarization doesn't take into account is that people have very, very compelling reasons to come here.
Right.
They have the best reasons in the world. One thing that I've said to people is that people migrate. They leave their home community, the language, their friends, their family for the best reason, which is love. It's usually love. It's usually somebody is sick and they need to come north for money to work so that they can help that person go to the hospital. They want to be reunited with their family in the United States. Or they have enough respect and dignity for themselves that they want to be out of the situation, dire poverty and violence, and they come north because of those reasons. And you know, to think that a wall or any amount of militarization is going to stop people from coming does not take into account how the factors that drive people to migrate in the first place.
Human desperation.
And, yeah, and human love and human dignity and human desperation, all of those things, yeah.
You want to add to that, Catherine?
Well, I think Kate's right in that, you know, the push factors are stronger and people will just try over and over again until either they make it or they die trying. And,
Do you have the numbers? What are the numbers of what are the estimated numbers of people successfully getting through what exists now? Do you know?
Actually, it's interesting because there are different numbers depending on who you ask. Under the bill, they're saying that first of all, none of this would go into effect. This is under the Senate bill until 90% of people who attempt to cross are turned back.
Mm-hmm.
The Tucson sector, which is the Border Patrol division that we work in, claims to have something between 85 and 90% what they call operational control, which means that they're claiming that number of people are turned away. But there's actually just a study published that used drone information with the ability to, you know, track to see groups of people and then see what happened to them if they get apprehended by Border Patrol or not. And that came out something more like 40 or 50% apprehended.
Mm-hmm.
So one concern that we have absolutely is how are we going to measure these border security triggers, and is this just a way to delay all the,
right,
what we would say are the positive parts of the bill, the path to citizenship, visas for people to come and work, and, you know, different sorts of relief.
Right.
So hinging it all on border security is really dangerous, in our opinion.
Kate, you make the comment, the border is everywhere, even in Champaign-Urbana. What do you mean?
Yeah, I think that people think of the border as this far-off thing that's just in California or Texas or Arizona, and they forget that the border is everywhere. The border is anywhere where people are living without a status to protect them from discrimination, exploitation, raids, violence. And that definitely applies to the Champaign-Urbana area. You know, we're in the middle of cornfields. So obviously, when we think about that, that means that there are agricultural workers, and a lot of them come here to work in the fields, and then they end up staying. The Latino population of Champaign-Urbana has doubled in the last decade. And obviously, not everybody who is Latino is undocumented. That's an important assumption to challenge.
Right.
But I, you know, knowing a lot of people who still work and live in Champaign-Urbana and are advocates for immigrant rights here, a fair number of people are undocumented in the Champaign-Urbana area, and they face the fact that, you know, without the kind of protections from visas or green cards or citizenship, that they are discriminated from housing.
From healthcare,
absolutely. It means that they're going to be exploited at work and not given fair wages. It means that their children within their schools are also going to be denied services. I think to something to be celebrated is that the Champaign-Urbana area has begun to respond to this growing population. And there's a very successful bilingual education program in the grade schools and also in Urbana as well. There are definitely things to be celebrated, but I really hope that people realize that there are parents and children in this community who have crossed through the desert, or who have family members who have crossed through the desert, who have experienced that kind of tragedy in their lives and continue to sort of live under the veil of undocumentation within Champaign-Urbana. So immigration reform is not just something to be thought of on the border, but something to be thought of as having a profound effect on our community as well.
It affects the whole society.
Absolutely.
Systemically.
Absolutely.
This sort of segues into our next week's program, by the way. I was going to announce next week on Keeping the Faith, we have two guests from a local organization called Champaign-Urbana Citizens for Peace and Justice, Mr. James Kilgore and Carol Ammons, who will be our most likely guest. And they'll be talking with us about a campaign here in Champaign County entitled No More Jails in Champaign. There will also be a discussion of the report on the Criminal Justice Task Force, which is going to be presented at a community meeting here in Champaign-Urbana on June 25th, and we'll hear more about that if you're interested. I believe we have a caller on line one. Hello, you're on Keeping the Faith. You have a question or comment?
Yeah, I had an incident yesterday, while on my way to Chicago, I stopped at a rest stop, and it was really obvious to me that the men around me were not speaking Spanish, and were not speaking English. So I asked one of them, who also spoke English, what he was speaking, and it was Mayan language, which I kind of suspected. And I wondered how many people from Central America and the Lower Yucatan are coming over. And I have no idea how many people from that area are coming.
Okay. Kate, Catherine, Kate first.
Is your question specific to, like, how many immigrants from Central America are coming into Champaign-Urbana or just generally coming into the United States?
I guess both. And how many are there a lot of undocumented coming from those areas still? I know when, the Mott, Rios Mott, reign of terror was going on, there were a lot of them. And I was surprised to hear, you know, this language. And then I'm hearing your show. And I know that a lot of the undocumented are from areas of Mexico, mostly Spanish-speaking, but I just wondered how many are Maya.
Now, Spanish-speaking is not the only language in Central or South America.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I actually don't have the numbers in front of me or like a breakdown of within the Latino population of Champaign-Urbana how many are from Central America. But one thing I do know is that in the 80s, when there were massive genocides happening in Central American countries and the sanctuary movement was started,
right,
people of faith organizing together to say that we will give sanctuary to people who are victims of human rights abuses in Central America, that there was a sanctuary movement present in Champaign-Urbana.
Mm-hmm.
St. Mary's Church and I believe McKinley Foundation,
Foundation.
Both took in people sanctuary here in Champaign. So it would not surprise me if sort of that historical legacy within Champaign-Urbana still influences people coming from Central America to emigrate to Champaign-Urbana. But Catherine, do you have more information on anything about Central Americans in general as migration patterns?
I don't have, you know, the exact figures either, but I do know that in general the proportion of people crossing the border who are from Central America is rising. One thing that's happened over the last about year and a half is that there's a new migration corridor that seems to be opening up in Southeast Texas, and by all reports that's primarily Central Americans trying to cross there. And I think in the last year there were 130 deaths in that area, which is almost, unfortunately, it seems like it might overtake the area that we work in soon. And to speak to the language question, we absolutely run into people for whom it's clear that they don't speak Spanish very well and it's not their first language. And that can pose some translation issues, especially if you're like me and your Spanish is already pretty spotty. Kate speaks a lot better than I am.
The diversity from Central and South America is greater than what many people are aware, but I was quite surprised to hear you both say so many are coming back speaking good so-called American English because they have been deported from this country. Before we go on, let me just remind our listeners we're talking to Kate Morgan Olson and Catherine Gaffney, who both have been Desert Aid workers for several years now in Arizona, dealing with the human toll of border militarization as a way of trying to shut down immigration flow into the United States. And we're talking about the effects of this as they recounted in two recent articles in Tycoon Magazine and Nation Magazine. And if you'd like to talk to either Catherine or Kate, you can call in locally 333-9455. There's also an 800 number, 1-800-222-9455. Well, as I understand it, there's some Mexico projects. Can you describe those on the other side of the border? What are you doing there, or what is going on there?
Yeah, so no more deaths. Actually, as we've been talking a lot about the desert aid work that happens, and that was the primary project that No More Deaths started in 2004. But since then, we've expanded, and we also have a project in Nogales, Sonora, and also Agua Prieta, that offers support to people who have been recently deported. Something that we know is that when people are deported, they frequently haven't spoken to their families in a very long time, and that can result in the guide calling and basically staging a fake kidnapping. So if the person hasn't been in touch and their families don't know that they've been taken into custody and they haven't made it, mm-hmm. the guide has the opportunity to call and say, I have your son, your daughter, you need to send me this amount of money, or I'm going to kill them. That money then is spent. Sometimes it's the life savings of the family, mm-hmm. but that person isn't even with the guide. So we help people be in touch with their families so that they can prevent that. And also we help them. We give medical services on that side of the border. We help them get bus tickets home, et cetera. It's a really important project. Something that's come out of that is as we were talking to people who have been in custody with U.S. law enforcement, they started to tell us about some of the abuses they experienced in custody. We started taking note of that, and the Abuse Documentation Project was born. And after years of documenting what people have experienced, we published the Culture of Cruelty Report, which documents systematically all of the abuses that people we were encountering were experiencing. While they were in custody, and that report has been used to sort of advocate for stricter accountability within Border Patrol.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Abuse Documentation Project, you didn't really talk that much about in your article. Catherine, do you know much about that in terms of the statistics? What is it that you have reported, or what is that, what has been reported, not necessarily you?
Sure. Our most recent report documented 33,000 abuses that happened in Border Patrol custody.
Mm-hmm.
And those are all, you know, firsthand reports of people. The abuses in custody range from denial of food and water, which was, I believe, the most common. Mm-hmm. And denial of food and water is an abuse in any case, but when people just come out of walking in the desert for a week, that obviously can be a great danger to life. Other complaints include family separation, really disgusting conditions in Border Patrol custody, extreme overcrowding, and essentially all the work that happens that No More Deaths does on the Mexican side of the line is remedial. You know, it's getting people back in touch with their family members who they've been separated from during the deportation process, or helping them recover their belongings that are in Border Patrol custody and, you know, weren't returned with them, or we also do abuse documentation in the desert. We very often find that our water gallons have been slashed, and we've got footage of Border Patrol agents coming up on our life-saving supplies with their knives and, you know, cutting them up. So that's another piece of desert.
Let's just take that one act. Is that illegal?
Go ahead, Catherine.
As best you
can. It should be.
So when you say abuse documentation, you just mean in general moral abuse, physical abuse, but you're not documenting it for legal purposes.
We have filed, I think, thousands of letters of complaint to the supposed oversight agency or authority within Border Patrol and received virtually no responses. So we take our case to the media and to the public instead.
Mm-hmm. Well, as I understand it from your article, there were two desert aid workers who were arrested for aiding and abetting. Would you tell us a little bit about that story?
Yeah, this was in, I'm going to forget the year now. I think it was 2006. Is that right, Catherine?
I think so.
Yeah. Daniel and Shanti were in the desert. They were working in the desert. They are two No More Deaths volunteers, and they encountered two people who were very, very ill, one person who was throwing up blood. And, you know, we have a set of protocols that we agree upon when we do a medical evacuation. We document how sick the person is. We call it into our medical team. We get clearance from them to do an evacuation. As Catherine said many times, we're very, very far from any kind of medical care. So that means us transporting these people to critical
miles,
care.
20 miles.
It depends on where you are, but something around that nature. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so we had done, and they had also been in touch with the lawyers saying that this was going to happen. And they were pulled over by Border Patrol while they were on the road. And Border Patrol pulled them out of the car, pulled the sick people out of the car, told Daniel and Shanti that they were transporting illegally. They're aiding and abetting. And they faced about a 2-year trial where they were looking at something around like 10 years in prison for providing this kind of aid. But we fought them and we won. We won successfully. All charges were dropped. And again, it was on the grounds that humanitarian aid is never a crime and that what we do is not illegal, that providing life-saving resources to someone is not illegal. I think that the biggest impact of that trial was the political power to remain in the desert, to say, you know, people, the public really supported no more deaths. And we were able to say, no, we have a right to be here to provide aid. And that was a success that came out of that trial.
There have been no legal efforts to change the legal status of desert aid workers. I know that in other states, I think maybe Georgia, I don't really know what I'm talking about here, there have been laws passed making it illegal for churches to harbor undocumented workers.
Do you know anything more about that, Catherine?
That specific legislation, but
no.
We've won every case that we fought.
This is in
and,
Arizona.
You know, legal other charges in Arizona, mm-hmm. right, although essentially we're not operating under state jurisdiction. We're really under state jurisdiction, but really everything we're dealing with is federal level because we're within Border Patrol zone of jurisdiction. So those are the agents we're typically running into. But we've won every case, and that includes also something as small as a littering charge, which a volunteer was given for putting out water in the desert, and rather than the fine, we fought it all the way up to district court and won.
Littering charge?
Littering charge for a life-saving gallon of water in the desert.
Amazing.
And yeah.
Well, we just have about 6 or so more minutes. Let me just try a few questions out on you for a more general audience. What is wrong with using the expression illegal aliens? I understand that Governor Brewer actually used the term illegal persons in Obama's presence, but what do you say to people who use that expression?
I mean, my reaction is that no human being is illegal. There can be maybe illegal actions, but no human being themselves is illegal. I wish that I meant to do some more research on sort of language before I came into this interview, but as far as I know, the first time that illegal started being used was around Jews during the Nazi occupation. This is language that is very intentional to marginalize and criminalize a group of people so that they can be exploited and harmed by the state and by other groups of people. So that's where my personal reaction comes into that, is that this isn't actually describing anything about the person. It's describing how our society is treating that person.
Catherine?
Yes, and it's not an innocuous term. I mean, it is designed to further the criminalization of immigration, which essentially, you know, before September 11th was seen as a civil affair. I mean, immigration law is within the civil realm. People don't have the right to a criminal defense attorney when they're being prosecuted for violations, and it feeds into the entire private prison system that is really a growing force in this country. So it's, you know, not only a personally offensive term, but really is part of the trend of how immigration is increasingly seen in the country.
If you all had the opportunity, what would you tell the Gang of Eight trying to get immigration reform law passed in the Senate today? What is it that you think is needed in this reform law that's not there?
I mean, I would tell not just the Gang of Eight, but everyone that border militarization is a failed strategy. The only thing that it has succeeded in doing is killing many thousands of innocent people. That it's something that should be opposed, and it is something that should not be made the hinge for relief for other undocumented people in this country.
Catherine?
Right, and that just the foundation for immigration policy in the country should be family unification and, you know, keeping communities together and upholding the dignity of each person, and should not be based in, you know, getting profits for private prisons or in providing cheap labor.
We haven't had a chance to talk yet about the extent to which you document in your two op-ed pieces the profit motive in keeping the border militarized, but maybe we'll have an opportunity to do so. We have a caller on line one. You're on Keeping the Faith. Question or comment?
Yeah, good enough. Concerning calling people illegal, the earliest that I had come across any use of that involved in the 1950s illegitimate children, and I rose a stink as a young man about that. It's impossible to go around calling to making our wonderful society more segregated than what it was, remembering that the original Europeans in this area were both Spanish and French speaking, and people without paper, the 50s were dogs, but now we're getting to be worse. I'm ashamed of it.
Yes, the pilgrims who showed up on Plymouth Rock were illegal, and they were alien. Suppose you could argue.
All right.
Let's move on a little bit to talk a little bit about the organization itself. Can you, if someone is interested in being involved, can you give us a quick website number?
Sure. It's www.nomoredeaths.org. And there's also the No More Deaths Volunteer Network, which, Kate, is at nomoredeathsvolunteer.com?
Yeah, nomoredeathsvolunteers.org.
Thank you very much, Kate and Catherine, Kate Morgan Olson and Catherine Gaffney, for being with us today to talk about your work as desert aid workers in Arizona. Thank you for being listening to Keeping the Faith. See you again next week.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
This is Ira Glass of This American Life. Every week on our program, we choose a theme, and this week, the theme is This Week. We're going to bring you favorite stories from the 7 days leading up to the program. We will cover big news stories in a way you will not hear anywhere else, and small personal stories unfolding far from any TV cameras or news gatherers. A radio searchlight across the week we all lived through this week.
Saturday afternoon at 1 and Sunday evening at 6 on AM 580.
Hi, I'm Jim Fleming, host of To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI. Looking for something to talk about at your next party or around the water cooler on Monday morning? Check in on To the Best of Our Knowledge each week. Science and religion, rethinking animal intelligence, maybe how memory works. Fascinating discussion on To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Sunday evening from 7 to 9 on AM 580.
Thanks for making us a part of your Sunday night. This American Life with Ira Glass is on the way. I'm Jason Croft, and you're listening to Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3 Urbana. You can also find us online at will.illinois.edu. At 7 o'clock, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. In the first hour, the topic is the economics of well-being. Then at 8, hour 2 looks into the timely topic of privacy. Stay tuned.